overseas. Yeah, I did that.
No, you did that.
Well, it's more than escapism. It's amazing for wiping out your debts.
Well, there's this unconventional
thing. But then, I mean, it's like, that's just a small thing, you know, just wiping out your debts. And, you know, but then you still got to live.
I guess it depends on how you feel about it.
You come back and, you know, it's like, you got to have more debts again. Yeah. You're living in North America, Western culture. Mm. You can't escape it. That's what I wanted to get away from. I, too, have a lot of debts. Student loans and everything. It's just like, I'm just going around in circles.
Maybe there's a reason why, like, South Korea can pay a lot of money. It is a well-industrialized country.
Yeah, they're developing quite a bit now.
Yeah, pretty developed.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're fighting hedge funds, too, and trying to start up a lot of new energy programs. But either way, like, the whole, like, global system, you see this trend of, like, walking the unbeaten path.
Yeah.
Either people who even, like, join the army these days, instead of a draft, they've got, like, these huge incentives to get an education, pay off your debt, just, you know, because all you inner-city kids aren't going to have a future anyhow, so you might as well just come on this way off the beaten path. Don't have to work a 9-to-5 anymore.
Yeah.
You can do something good for the world, and you feel like you are. But it's an alternative that's given to us instead of working a job that otherwise isn't an economy that has no future. Because
it's true.
Things have just been wired in such an insane way.
Yeah.
And people are, I think, taught that that's the only way, not think, but I mean, that's really the thing, is that we're sort of taught that that's the only way we're allowed to think in the guidelines that's been given. So
That's been the thinking for the last, I don't know, 100 years or so. You go to school, get a good education, get a good job, and, buy a house, start a family, you know. It's like, it's kind of like, it's so much propaganda. It's just like,
I think
and you can't even work for a good company more than 5 years anymore.
Yeah.
The days of working 20, 30, 40 years for a company collecting a pension and retiring for like 20, 30, 40 years, it's
not to mention the prospect of supporting a family.
No, it's like families don't want to have more than two kids anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, what's up with that? You know, it's like the older generation, we're having like 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 kids, you know.
It's like, it's a huge thing with these values that we all have within us, you know, to do this thing that we, you know, our parents expect of us, and we want this, we want to have this family, we want to have this, we have this idea of something we should do, go to get our education, do this thing, but then we don't take into account that there might be an underlying intention that's been governing, like when Social Security was implemented is a great example. In the 40s or 30s, when it was introduced under Roosevelt, this was a completely separate system that was created where that money was being put to work immediately. So you had a working economy, you know, money that was being taken off people's paychecks, being put directly into development. So buying securities and then developing infrastructure, putting people to work. So, you know, if you're thinking about the future that way, you could have a growing population and a growing family, and Social Security, it doesn't become that Ponzi pyramid scheme.
As long as it works, you know.
Yeah, it's the thing. Then you read people today, and they're all like, oh, it's a big farce. It was never meant to work anyhow. Now look at all these baby boomers who are going to retire.
Yeah.
And it was doomed to fail from the start.
Yep.
But then, what I was going to get at with the briefing here is just that this is an element of a much, much bigger picture, which we're, here in the LaRouche movement, what we're trying to address is these root causes. And you have a very large lack of this in political parties around the world. And people, you know, you have people who are doing a lot of good, a lot of people who are just lost, and it's really getting to figuring out what is really driving the events that we see, the intentions that we can begin to solve them. And a lot of times these root causes are, rather than mistaking the effects, like, you know, people who say that overpopulation or that there's a baby boomer social security problem caused by not thinking about the fact that populations will have to level off at some point, but thinking in a certain way, when you're looking at like these problems, you're really seeing effects of the problem, or corporations having a lot of control or pollution.
Exactly.
And we tend to act on the effects, but we're not seeing the causes. So what we're looking at today, I think most importantly, is a few different perspectives that we have to take into account. And the emerging war in Iran in the Middle East is one of the key factors that we have to always look at, that LaRouche has been talking about since 2004, that this has been a driver for the neocon apparatus, is that there's an intention to essentially find any excuse necessary to go to war in Iran. I just like you had a similar situation in pre-Nazi Germany. I mean, this is history repeating to, as the cliche goes, but to an extreme. Because World War II was decided much longer, like 5 years before the war actually broke out. And it really wasn't a question of how it was going to occur, but really just that it was going to happen in some way. As you had a financing of Hitler via a lot of the coffers from Wall Street, from London City, and what we have with the neocons is something very, very similar to this. And it's a question of, well, you see this manifesting today with, lately you've had three generals, each one successfully, as the Bush administration is looking for another war czar, a puppet to sort of take the blame for the Iraq war, all this stuff, and what's emerging. They've all turned it down. Like, every single one of them has come openly said no. This is idiotic. There's no way out of this. I'm not going to ruin my life with this. And that's indicative of a larger desire, which is just insane. Because you also have the Iran surrounded by battle carriers too, two battle carrier fleets around the Persian Gulf. And meanwhile, I mean, this is just a smaller part of a plan where people will look at this and maybe think that this is where they want to go. But ultimately, what we have is America being induced to destroy itself, and this is the most important factor to take into account, because we have another world war at our doorstep if we don't begin to look at these things in a new light. And people see this, and Russia sees this, and China is aware of these manipulations to some degree, not to the full degree by any means, but they can see that this is occurring. And you have this general, a Russian general named Vladimir Belous, who recently made the comment yesterday, actually, that the U.S. having built its... it's been building, or
what's
has plans to
that,
build.
General? Is that the Russian?
Yeah, it's Vladimir Belous, and he's a leading expert on anti-ballistic weapons. And he was quoted in The Guardian, which is a European newspaper, mm-hmm. saying the geography of the U.S. ballistic missile defense system in Eastern Europe. Deployment doesn't give any doubt that the main targets are Russian and Chinese nuclear forces. The U.S. bases represent a real threat to our strategic nuclear forces. So you have this occurring. I mean, this is indicative of how the war in Iran is just a pretext for something much larger. And this is something that we as a global community, we as human beings living on this planet, hoping for a future, have to begin to address. And this is one direction. I mean, you also have on this American side an economic situation that we also have to address, and that's that up until 1972, we were operating in America at least was operating as under a Bretton Woods system set forth by FDR, which had a fixed exchange rate system with a gold reserve standard, facilitating a fair exchange around the world of products, developments, mm-hmm. and you had a view of the future with, I mean, Kennedy's space programs. You had a general acknowledgement that we had a future, and that the reason for an economy was it served a purpose other than just to measure money and just to make wealth. That in 72 was, I think, one of those most important points that LaRouche always goes back to, and it's just key that people don't tend to look at too so often, is that Kissinger and the George Shultz apparatus who was working within the Nixon administration floated the dollar. And at that moment, you had an effective new era in world politics that has created a new system that's just completely unsustainable. And that system, that floating of the dollar, making it reliant on a complete demand and supply and demand basis, making it completely based on the markets, was one of the leading factors in creating a complete decay into a free trade, a more and more free trade, more and more speculative system of deregulation, like less government regulation, more let the markets decide what they're doing. And I mean, you had these figures who were key in doing this, of Kissinger, of Schultz, mm-hmm. of Felix Hohat, and these characters who were there in the Nixon administration. They were there in Carter and Ford, Bush Senior, Reagan, and they're there today. I mean, these guys are, you know, Bernard Lewis, George Shultz, Cheney. These guys are advisors to Dick Cheney, mm-hmm. Kissinger. So we have to see things in that light. And what's been created, and we've become a completely monetarist system, meaning that we now track the value of money, and only money, GDP. We choose to measure one thing, assuming that that's an economy. That's not really an economy, but that's what you'll come out of school thinking if you go to any Harvard or any school for that matter at this point. Adam Smith, he was apparently the father of modern economics. But what's occurring now, if we look at the trends, what's been created has been bubbles upon bubbles, and we've lost largely in Canada and the U.S. over 50% of our productive capacity, what we used to produce 35, 40 years ago. Yeah. So these bubbles include such things, and I mean each one tends to last a little less long, a little shorter than the previous one. And what we have right now is a massive housing bubble. It's in like 2001, you had a dot-com bubble that just floundered. Yeah. And so what happens? What do you do when a bubble pops? Well, if you're the Federal Reserve, if you're Alan Greenspan, you plug that bubble up and make a new bubble. Because mm-hmm. you could do something like Bill Clinton was trying to do with Jiang Zemin in China and try and reconstruct the financial system that you know is not working, that doesn't have a future. You could do that, and you could risk an impeachment by a Monica Lewinsky scandal that just pops up. Or you could be a predatory idiot like anybody running the current world markets, and choose to find a way to just, you know, we're out of money, let's find a way to scam more money. Let's bleed this thing even, this dead horse deader still. Let's bring it back to life and bleed it some more. And so, you know, you have the dot-com bubble that exploded, and what's the Federal Reserve do? They lower the interest rates on housing and decide to create a new housing market, make it a frenzy of people who want to own property, real estate, and bring the mortgage, the interest rates down to like 1%, make it accessible to anybody, and you do that. And everybody's buying houses. Everybody thinks, and the value's going up because everybody wants it. It's like a baseball card, you know, that everybody wants. It's still paper. I mean, but I remember as a kid, I'd just like sit, save tons of money and buy that stupid little baseball card that still made of the same kind of cardboard, but there was a demand for it. I don't know, but so that's what you have. And knowing that that's what's carrying our market, the security of our entire economy, is just what people want from one day to the next is, if you're a rational human being, it's kind of disconcerting. So this housing bubble is key. And these things have been getting bigger and bigger, and you had, 7 years of this now, of just a frenzy of more and more people wanting this stuff, and another this is over capacity. This has achieved a level of capacity now that it can't sustain. It's still the same material that a house that's now worth somehow $400,000 that you paid $80,000 for.
Yeah.
Still the same material. There's nothing there to it, but this is now all the banks are relying on these assets for like 50% of their
value.
Yeah, their value. So that's of the banks. The banks are like half in deep for this. But then on top of the real estate markets, you also have the subprime, and that's an interesting one, because with the subprime, the subprime mortgages were a new phenomenon around that time of 2001, where pretty much anybody, Guillermo sitting over there with a look of curiosity on his face, would be able to get a house today if he wanted one. It doesn't matter if you don't really have credit or if you don't have a job. You can get it. You can get a house.
Well, let's see if you have all that you need. You need to have no job. Okay, you have that.
Score.
You have to be unable to pay the mortgage. Okay, you have that. You have to you have to...
not already have a house?
And you speak Spanish, so that's probably good.
That's true. They hit the minorities, that's, you got it.
Wow. So, okay,
yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. And I mean, how do you
the,
do that?
In the
like,
States?
Yeah, it's, you can get a $200,000 house.
Probably throw it right at you.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Nobody else would take it. So how do you get somebody with that qualification or lack of qualifications to own a house? Well, what if you just don't charge them? What if you just charge them like minimal interest rates so they pay maybe, you know, maybe they're earning $1,000 a month.
That's what they have been doing.
Yeah, that's what they have been doing. Yeah,
I've spoken to a lot of people.
I talked to a guy at McGill Metro when we were there this week.
Yeah.
A guy who works, you know, there's banks all around the McGill Metro.
Yeah.
I don't know. I asked him, you know, can you tell me where? He was, you know, reserved on that point. Where was he working?
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out, you know, where the guy was from and all that. So I went on to talking about these bubbles and the housing bubble and all that. And he said, yeah, that's true. It's really a mess right now. As I said, well, look at the subprime. Oh, that was a big mistake. That's what he said. That was a big mistake. I said, well, yeah, because, you know, the system is collapsing. Banks are bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I don't know if I would argue that. Well,
yes.
Who can pay for these things? Oh, yeah, true. The guy was really like, you know, it's all disconnected in his head. He's like, you know, I'm doing that because that's what they want to, you know, that's how I get paid. And
it's funny how...
Morally, I'm not supposed to be connected to what I'm doing.
Did he tell you where he works?
No.
It's strange how sometimes just asking the right question can really put somebody's piece together, right?
Yeah. it's a bad decision.
Yeah. That's forecasting trends. If you're reading the Wall Street Times or even the Montreal Gazette, it's telling you, now's the time to invest. I was reading the financial section of the Montreal Gazette last week, and it's just funny, I'm just going to go sidetrack here a little bit, but I mean, the front page is saying now is the time. Stocks are great, and this is the time to put your money in the market. And every second article, not every second, every article preceding that was just Goodyear drops 800 more employees in Quebec.
Yeah.
25,000 garment workers have been laid off since 2003 due to outsourcing, and every single article was just more. More layoffs, and it's such a paradox. If you're anybody who's thinking in reality, in realistic terms here, physical terms, you're seeing something here. But here, it's crazy. So these I just jotted down a few details about this housing market quickly here, but I mean, you've got one of the major mortgage lenders. It's bankrupt, and the foreclosure rate, it's another one of these little paradoxes, is up. It's risen by like 0.69% in like a couple of months. The delinquency rates are like skyrocketing, and meanwhile,
it's right across the United States. I spoke to a real estate agent who came from Florida, basically to escape the system down there, because he was in a lot of trouble. He had a lot of houses in his hands, and he had to leave because. I mean, all these homeowners owed so much money on their houses, and they couldn't pay anything.
Yeah.
All these people can't. They're selling their houses. They can't even sell their houses. They're just like.
You met him recently?
Yeah. I'm actually in. I'm gonna be in financial services, in investments, and in life insurance. And
that's the guy you met.
Mortgage.
Mm-hmm. You gonna work with him?
Yeah. No, he's. I don't know what he's gonna be doing. He's just hiding right now here in Canada. So I know very much what's happening in the States.
Yeah.
I read a lot of stuff.
Nothing
escapes me.
Yeah.
The last 25 years.
Remember those words.
Yeah. No, it's true. I read everything on the planet, you know, so I know what's going on. I mean,
cool.
Yeah, I do a lot of research and cross.
Have you ever heard about the movement? Like the our paper we put.
This?
Was it the first time you made us?
What do you mean?
This stuff?
Yeah, the air. Have you checked that out before?
Not this one, but the one he gave me in the metro. I've read it several times. Last year or two years.
Cool, yeah. All right. Yeah. I'll read them quickly, and
I just give it to somebody else to read.
That's good. Yeah. Hopefully you'll be able to get rid of that pile of the, in
all
those houses.
I left two different clients today.
Okay. All right, so this is the general idea, though. I mean, yeah, we all know that things are pretty messed up. So, what we have to look at, and as well, I mean, you got hedge funds, too. Hedge funds are another big one. Offshore gambling institutions that are just, bam. I mean, trillions of dollars are stuck in these things. And you got 350 of them that control 75% of the $2.5 trillion wrapped up in this market. That's just a fake market.
Yes,
and
exactly.
I just found out, too, you might find this one interesting. Today, companies can officially sell risks, derivatives risks, based on storms, whatever areas might be more inclined to be hit by a storm. The insurance premiums will go up in certain areas, so you can now bet on the derivatives and the differences that arise from weather, officially. I mean, you've always been able to do that a bit, but now it's like, it's official. And as well with Al Gore's propaganda popping out saying that all these storms are caused by global warming, is another thing that is propagating this whole market. Because even on top of these insane gambling on anything, you've got the new market that the head of the World Bank is loving up. Like, I mean, what's his name? Paul Wolfowitz, right? Yeah. I mean, said that he's been trumpeting the new $200 billion carbon swap market, which that's just $200 billion straight, and on top of the derivatives that'll come later from this potential, you're looking at trillions of dollars in one particular venue. Carbon swaps are what? Well, that's, if for most people have heard about them a little bit, but you know, it's as soon as something like Kyoto goes into effect, what's going to happen to these nations that all want industry, especially the third world? Well, they're going to have limits, quotas, how much carbon dioxide they're allowed to pump out in a year.
Okay.
And if you're an unindustrialized nation like Africa, India, or less so, then you're going to not be hitting that quota. You could have that, at that point, your extra carbon emissions that you haven't used, bought up, purchased by these hedge funds, like the one that Al Gore owns, which is important too, financial new generation investment, and sold to companies that pollute in excess. So you've got this emerging market based on nothing. Yet another bubble. Yeah. Yeah, and then you got the biofuels, too. So this is another thing as well. I mean, ethanol, biofuels, from one day to the next, people aren't asking why all of a sudden George Bush is touring South America, promoting this stuff. Schwarzenegger's going down to Britain, speaking on behalf of the Tories, promoting the new environmental. Like, he's a populist. The guy's coming out and saying, I'm not left, I can't do a German accent, but...
Yeah, you can.
I'm not left, I'm not right. I'm for the world. I can't do it. But
that's pretty good.
Thank you.
He's almost like Irish there.
he's a drinker too, I hear, but that's stereotyping, I'm sorry. But this is the thing. So you're just appealing to popular demand here.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile Al Gore's going down to Mexico, with his main sponsors is Barrick Gold up until today. Up until an hour ago. Yeah, sorry. Barrick Gold was the main sponsor to hosting his... Yeah, it was
Barrick Gold.
Huh? Yeah. And then what?
Wait,
they're no longer the backers?
Oh, no. He had... there was a huge controversy.
There was too much heat.
Yeah. We reported on this.
Putting too much heat on him. Not only us, but other groups
Oh yeah, Mexico, Chile. Yeah, it was Chile. Yeah. And Argentina.
Oh, in Chile,
wasn't it?
Okay.
Chile and Argentina.
Do you want Gore down there?
Huh?
Yeah.
Chileans were saying that it's contradictory to have Barrick Gold, one of the biggest polluters or the biggest sponsor, Al Gore, to go talk about greening the world.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And this Barrick Gold, I mean, this thing is special. Like, you have on the board of directors, you have Brian Mulroney, the guy who pushed NAFTA. You got Maury Strong, former head.
I heard an interesting story about him.
What's that?
I was tree planting with a guy whose father worked with Prime already before he became Prime Minister. And this guy was telling me that, you know, through his dad, he heard that Brian Mulroney had like an aversion to paperwork, where he'd actually hide it behind his couch.
Wow.
He would stuff paperwork behind his couch so he didn't have to do it.
What? Yeah.
That stuck in my mind, man.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, oh, right. Here you go.
Yeah, these guys aren't thinkers. They're used for their rhetoric. That's that's a rhetorician for you. Luke's all disillusioned now.
So what's that?
These guys aren't there for their brains. That's for sure.
He was able to take that party from something like 256 seats down to 2.
Wow.
People just couldn't wait to vote him out.
Yeah.
Kim Campbell came after he like stepped in
for like 2 minutes.
For 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And then she was able to get 2 of the 256 seats or something.
Yeah.
That they had before.
Yeah, they were being punished.
They went from 256 seats to 2. What do the progressive conservatives and an MG have in common?
MG?
Yeah, what's
it's
that?
A car?
Yeah, it's a car. Both have 2 seats. Yeah, he was bad. I
hated him.
I sort of grew up when he was prime minister, and now. There was this time when they were trying to redo the Canadian Constitution, it was a lot of work. Do you know the Charlottetown Accord?
The what? The Charlottetown?
Yeah.
Well, I know a bit about the story around that, and you know, Beach Lake, and how they made it happen so that they basically blame it on the native people.
Is that the way you thought of it? I didn't, because there was the leader of the native people who agreed to the.
It fucked up everything. It just
like
because yeah,
it
needed a consensus.
Well, it needed a consensus, but Joe Clark at that time did a very amazing thing. He was able to get 10 Canadian premiers and the native leader to agree on a piece of legislation, which was nearly impossible to do.
But
I knew it was doomed when Brian Mulroney got onto the camera, and he said, you know, he hadn't been part of any of it, any of the negotiations, nothing. It was all Joe Clark, and it was all, you know, Joe Clark with his very slow voice and kind of not a very big personality. But then, right at the last minute, after it's all done, Brian Mulroney jumps in front of the camera and he goes, "Listen, Canada, if you don't vote for this piece of legislation, this is what's going to happen to Canada," and he rips it up on in front of the camera. I'm like, you idiot. So dumb. Maybe he didn't want it to pass, you know.
Yeah.
I thought it was a pretty interesting piece of legislation.
So he basically pulled like a Howard Dean then or something, like a flip out, like a just a
berserker
rage.
He did this thing like try, I don't know.
Man. That's insane. We got a really good book in the back. You should really check it out. It's called the Betrayal of Canada by Mel Hertig. It's in the library. It's really good and goes into. It was written in the early 90s. So I mean, it's hitting on the whole Mulroney administration. It's a really good book, and just shows you how in that period of time, like pretty much all Canadian industry was just lost and incorporated by America. Through the American Free Trade Accord Agreement, all this stuff. We just lost it all. We became another extension. All of our, you know, of the British system in the United States. And it really goes in depth. It's really special for that.
What's it called?
The Betrayal of Canada. We can lend it to you, man. It's written back. But I mean, these guys like Mulroney. I mean, if you look at his positions, he's also the on the board of directors of Quebecor Inc., the biggest media conglomerate in Montreal, Canada, mostly Quebec, actually. But, you know, and this is part of other attacks that you're seeing around. Like, we're doing a lot of work on the Canadian Wheat Board, one of these last items of protection, government protection on the farmer that exists, and that's being attacked through these networks. And, I mean, through Quebecor Inc. is a huge one that's viciously attacking them. You know, we're discovering Brian Mulroney popping up left and right here in geopolitical events as just a little tool. But this, I mean, when you look at who's funding him, I mean, and especially today, it's ridiculous because even these hedge funds are, I mean, all of the presidential candidates that are running right now in the Democratic Party, and the Republican Party, I mean, these guys have more financing coming in from hedge funds than you could possibly, you could wave a finger at. I was reading a list, and it's only been $6 million contributed thus far in the 2008 races for the presidency. But I mean, this is more than ever. This is obscene already, and this is only the beginning. But I mean, you have Hillary Clinton. She's receiving like the most at $140,000. You got Barack Obama, who's got his $7 billion hedge fund that's supplying his campaign. Not to say that these guys are necessarily bad, but I mean, whose agenda are you going to be more inclined to represent if you don't have a conception of reality when you become a little, a little tool like a Mulroney? Maybe Mulroney is a little bit more vicious, but these guys, it's indicative of how could you have a fair system when you have this type of thing going on. And then you have McCain, Giuliani, John Edwards. He was even employed for like 14 months to a $7 billion hedge fund named Fortress Investment. So, we have to start seeing these things as what they really are. And the biofuels market is another one.
By the way, did you guys see the article run in the National Post in Canada?
Which one?
Right on the front page. Biofuel scam causing corn prices to rise. Did you see that?
Oh, I didn't see it, but
did you hear about that?
We published about that.
Yeah.
It was something on the website. Just
I think we referenced it.
National Post. It's one of two national Canadian papers.
It's been going on.
Global Mail.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Fidel Castro went out a couple of weeks ago.
But it's big that the National.
Yeah,
it's really big that the National Post is saying that, though. That's weird.
Yeah, front page.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not the article wasn't front page, but the there was a
That's fantastic.
Bold type.
That's the type of thing. I mean, yeah, you have like the Mexican agricultural minister who's saying it, and a lot of people are. And it's not a secret that this stuff is causing Mexican farmers to have to spend double the price on corn stock and corn and tortillas than ever before. This is part of globalization. But you talk to people about this, and you wonder why they're not doing anything. Like you mentioned, and the answer is pretty clear too, because you have up until like 8-9 years ago, you still had a movement in the Democratic Party in the States that had an outlook of revitalizing the system. I mean, even after Clinton, you're still pushing for. A little after Clinton, you still had an outlook of development, of welfare, of social security, of doing things for the future, not robbing from it. And since then, you've had a huge this whole popularization of Al Gore's hoax is completely destroyed the issue. Nobody's addressing this anymore. And so, like, this is what we have to look at, like. You know, people will stare blankly when you mention any of this stuff sometimes, or even mention the fact that it might be a little strange that 17,000 climate scientists have signed petitions since 1998 saying that this is anti-development, this is fake science, and are refuting the consensus of like the top 250 or 2,500 scientists. And people, there's a disconnection there. And so what we really have to do is try and bring this whole reality to people and show them what the real crisis is and what really needs to be addressed. In the Democratic Party, in our parliamentary work, in our congressional work, and this is what we're on the forefront doing, is the LaRouche movement, and nobody else is heading this up in this way. And in the interventions alone as well. So, I mean, what we have to really look at too is that these paradoxes aren't something that a society should be living with necessarily. Like, to have 19,000 new welfare recipients in the last month show up in the United States while everybody's saying that the economy's booming. This is an echo of Calvin Coolidge right before the Great Depression saying that stocks are cheap, right before he goes out of office and bam, you got a depression. But we're thinking in terms of trends now, and we're not thinking in terms of truth or of science. It's just like, all right, everybody's opinions are relative.
It's funny because you have move on organization.
Org. Yeah.
And you know, it's like kind of trendy being like Democrat, like against Bush and stuff like that. So like they open this organization.
Yeah.
And it's funny because they're like, they have good will and stuff, but they don't do the right thing, you know. And for example, I was looking on YouTube, you know, they had a super conference like adoring Al Gore.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, this is a save, you know, he's gonna save us.
Yeah, that's the thing. People want to do good. That's their it's a very human desire to want to do good for your future, and you don't want corruption, you don't want smelly crap coming out of your cities and stuff. It doesn't, it's something that you'd rather you didn't, you know, you don't want that. And so it's just like the military, how it's bringing people in. Hey, Marco, how you going? Hey, just like I was talking at the beginning there, just like how the military is sucking people in right now, and just how you have all these people walking off the beaten path to try and do something unconventional that seems good. I mean, it's a trap. And yeah, and with this thing too, it's no different. But it's a reflection of having seen the symptoms and mistaking that for the cause. And so you fight corporations, and you fight Bush, and you fight cars, because they, you know, because you see that's pollution, and it causes asthma. But you're willing to embrace draconian anti-human depopulation policies like Kyoto now that are wrapped up in love. And it's just
feelings.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. I mean, you're not using that much reason. I mean, you believe what you see. It makes sense. Apocalyptic computer models say it so. Who are you to question it? Human nature seems pretty bad if you look at it empirically. So yeah, you'll do some. And then too, I mean, you've had a huge brainwashing too of a portion of the population who was born in between 1945 and 1958, who went through a certain type of unconventional upbringing, to say the least, involving a lot of LSD, a lot of drugs, a lot of rock and roll, and an attack on a culture and a form of education that has no place for truth. Really just relativistic ideas of what may or may not be an intelligent approach to science or to, you know, philosophy or to anything. It's just like, respect it all. It's everybody's opinion. We're live in the now. You know, you also had a threat of looming nuclear Holocaust as well for these people, so it's another trauma to just imagine yourself growing up in that type of a world where you have these looming threats of imminent destruction, communist threats of don't speak up or you'll get daddy in trouble, or things of that nature. And it does something to a population, as we could see. And so you don't have to go too far to see where this outlook is, this paradigm is coming from. You know? And so how do you have to see the economy? And this is the main focus of the LaRouche movement here, and Lynn LaRouche is a physical economist, and he's looking at this like a science, and not just like a climate science, like a quasi science, but like a real what the reason why science exists is encapsulated in the method taken on by Lynn LaRouche, and has been since he made his discovery in how to forecast physical economic growth or in our sad cases thus far, depressions, collapses, and how to see it in terms of knowing what to measure. And you're not measuring money. This is not something that any, you know, you could walk down the street and explain to an economy teacher why this thing's going down. You could explain how we've lost the physical capacity to produce, and you know, you could mention that we use slave labor and 3 billion people living in poverty is a necessity. You can explain this stuff. But it, when their answer is coming out like, oh, that's insane, we have more money now than ever, is a problem. And this is the thing when you measure GDP, or you're axiomatically thinking that that's an economy. And so what we have to do is get people to see the physical necessity of an environment within a society that contains and develops human beings. You know? So
not only our society, but the world together. You know, when you have cheap labor and stuff, you cannot need it. You cannot be like, you know,
yeah,
Well, that's normal. That's good for us. You know.
Yeah. But what if you think that that's the only way to be? Like, what if you think that slave labor, free trade, is the only option that an economy could have? If you're sold that, then your potential to make a creative breakthrough in how to solve a problem is massively diminished. And this is what we have to contend with. But, yeah, I mean, we have to go back to a Roosevelt's approach to, like, why did Roosevelt create the Bretton Woods? These are the types of questions we have to go back and frequent to see what his intentions were. And that if you look at the nature of that whole period of time when he was combating, when he beat this fascist threat to the world, it was done so with an intention of developing the Third World. And he said so. It was documented by his son, Elliot Roosevelt, in a book, As He Saw It, who was his advisor, and documented his conversations with Churchill, saying how this your colonialism is a thing of the past. This is 18th century methods. This is the 20th century. We need 20th century methods. We have to develop these people, and if you keep them living like backwater animals, you're going to get wars. You're going to get these problems. So you need to help them develop. How do you do that? Well, you know, greed the deserts of Africa. These are the types of development projects that we don't have a capacity to do in the trap of an economy that currently is dominating North American and European normality. So, what do we have to look at? Argentina. We have to look at the places in the world that we can learn from that we're just media isn't reporting on because they just don't know how to see the problems, really. You know, you just see fragmentary effects. So, you know, you start looking at what LaRouche is calling a nuclear renaissance that's emerging right now. Well, first, I mean, Argentina, this is a great example of somebody, a really powerful leader, the type that we, people who say that, you know, leaders are corrupted, or people in power are inherently corrupted, and you get this argument on the street all the time. Like, people are just jaded. It's like, if you're in power, you'll be corrupt. It's human nature to be, no, I mean, you gotta see these guys for, you know, see what's really going on. And then you see somebody like President Kirchner, who came into power, 2003, his country was being exploited by the IMF as being used for being raped for 20 years, a little bit more, and basically said these are draconian policies that we can never repay, so we're not going to repay it. As a responsible leader, I can do that as a president of a country, of a nation with sovereignty. So I won't. We're just going to pay, like, what, 30%, 40% maybe, not even. And we'll do that on our terms. The rest, we're just not going to. And now I'm going to start nationalizing all these privatized industries, which is what he proceeds to do and does, and putting money into development, healthcare, education. And you have, since 2003, the greatest period of growth that Argentina's seen in, I think probably ever. And this is going on right now with Ecuador, too. You got international, in South America, it's a huge potential growing here amongst Cuba, amongst all these nations who are breaking off from the status quo, from what it was expected of them to be good little slaves. And so this type of thing and that we have to start really, really taking seriously. And then on top of that, internationally speaking, you once again that nuclear renaissance that LaRouche is saying that now is the time. And I'm looking into this thing now, and it's amazing. You've got Russia developing 8 floating nuclear power plants, nuclear reactors for the east and the north coasts. You got India collaborating with Russia. Russia's going to help them build the thorium reactor. They've also got India in some of the poorest areas through Tamil Nadu building 12 more reactors throughout that area and high-speed rail. Ukraine's got similar projects going on in cahoots with China and India. China, Japan, just today, let alone just today, China and Japan made agreements with the federal minister of Japan and the Chinese trade and reform minister to cooperate on a development plan of nuclear technology. And in Texas, even in the United States, you have a plan to build 5 reactors in Texas. That's Armenia too, and this is Brazil, another big one being pushed through. And this is a huge move for developing huge capacities of energy for a growing population, which is a necessity. Unlike what Al Gore and all of these people who care about the future, who have chosen to take this on as their lifestyle, because this is something that they feel comfortable doing. Their intuition tells them that this is something I should do. This is my identity now as an environmentalist. Well, they'll argue too that industry is bad. What these people like, they get, you know, they like being poor. It, not poor, but I mean, they they like having their tribal lifestyle. It's not something that you necessarily need to change. It's not a who says that's our
but
Gore's place
doesn't exactly embody that.
No, but he's saying that we need to use less energy. We need to conserve energy.
Just not him personally.
Not him personally, yeah, right. Yeah, not the modicum of...
No.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this guy is...
Do as I say, not as I
do. Yeah. Thanks, Dad. Yeah, even the zinc mine and his property is insane.
Even just his sheer size.
That's pretty nuts, too, yeah. Well, I think we've been giving him a hard time. I mean, we've been pretty much intervening on him on pretty much almost every single... display of perversion that he's given to the population around the world, and every single time we do so, we're making him look like an idiot. So I can imagine him dipping into those extra meals and deep fried food as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's probably not helping his situation. These guys are saying conserve energy, and you know this is the nature of human existence. If you have people on the planet. Well, we're saying that you don't look at GDP, you look at something like mass relative population density, that quantity of the population that can be sustained via a certain quantity of technology and energy, or the energy flux, the energy that quantity of people have access to. You know, you have coal, you can have a certain quantity of people. You find a new form of technology, a new discovery of how to use energy at a higher state, that boundary that population has to grow just exceeds. Incredibly, that's the nature of development. And so going to something like wind or solar, like all of our northern Quebec farmers are being sold to do, go to wind, don't stop making food, go to wind, is just a completely backwater thing. And they're just happy that they're making money. But this is really that, you know, and it comes down to a question of why we don't know our history, why are things not changing? Well, when you have a certain capacity to know where you came from, if you think that it's always been this way and you think that human nature has always been corrupt, then your capacity to fight for something is greatly diminished too, your inclination to want to. So what I think is especially valuable is that we not only appreciate people like Roosevelt, what JFK was doing in the States. I mean, Lincoln, you have a huge legacy. This has been a question. When you look at history in terms of being governed by intentions, you can start seeing that there's always been a question of whether or not the world would be governed by free trade British imperial methods of using people like animals under a world government oriented system. In the case of the British, I mean that's really what it was, this empire of the British that, you know, used people like Adam Smith and people like Jeremy Bentham and all of these little stooges to impose monetarist philosophies upon nations that wanted to develop, and especially America. And this is why you had a battle and a revolution that you're not going to go to school and discover this stuff, because it's been, you know, it's like America just fought that battle to make their own empire.
Yeah.
This is indicative of people who don't know how to be rigorous or have a method in terms of figuring out what
happened.
What's governing the world? What's governing the universe? And so you look at the intentions, and now you can see that there's this question has been the American system as an economic force of development is our only chance of having a future. And it's embodied in the principles that Argentina is using right now. This ties into LaRouche's Four Nations development plan as well, because this is something that when you look at it this way from this framework, it becomes something that you could solve in a relatively easy way as long as you can break out of a certain axiomatic way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And so what LaRouche has recommended and proposed and what we've been fighting for years through this movement has been the cooperation of nations which largely are already cooperating with each other. And the biggest ones right now happen to be India, China, Russia, and America in terms of the most potency to make this change occur. And the most character in their history. I mean, that's a lot embedded in the population that gives them a chance to, with a revolutionary history, there's a lot that a population can be inspired to do, but it requires an identity in your history. And we can sit down and talk more about his plan, but, I mean, what Canadians lack largely is that sense of identity, I find, too. I mean, you have, as Dave over there so eloquently observed, but Quebec suffers a massive problem of existential, massive existential crises. The people on the streets of Quebec are just completely internalizing everything. And it's true, like, they're... You know, you don't get this in America. People are, like, more willing to yell at you. But this is a cultural question. I mean, this is part of our heritage. And when you produce something that people have pride for, that they can fight for, the fact that perhaps Canada actually has a revolutionary history, you know, throughout the Civil War, what I came in to realizing, and this has blown me away since I've been looking deeper into this in this movement, is that this, especially Rob, one of our members who you haven't met yet, well, you've met Rob, right? But he's been doing a lot of work at Canada's history. And just as you've had this battle waging in Roosevelt's time and JFK's time today, mm-hmm. you also had it waging in the Civil War. And Lincoln is one of these characters who we don't appreciate either for what he did. But he was representing, along with the people working around him, this Republican development outlook of an American system to break away from the British once again. And this is what engaged, this is what created, what spurred on the British to use the Confederate puppets that they were down south to start a war that was meant to break up an otherwise growing nation, the only threat to Britain. And you had, and this has blown me away, we have to look more into this, but just to give a little taste, we're going to be doing a lot more work on this. But there have been letters that Rob has uncovered from not only amazing figures who just have been written out of our history books, like Isaac Buchanan, who was a huge Republican figure, small r Republican, fighting for sovereignty of Canada away from the monarchy vigorously, but you also had a movement around the circles of Lincoln, and especially his consul general named John Fox Potter, who whose job was to spy on the Confederate networks in America, especially Montreal, and trying to organize Republican circles in Canada, too. And what we found are letters from one of his agents, Kelly, to John Fox Potter, which document how Kelly was assigned to contact a certain individual named Dessalles, Louis-Antoine Dessalles, to get him to work on cultivating a greater resistance to the British in French. And this is at a time when the Americans had just won the Civil War. Britain was on its way, six more years, it was going to be in a massive depression. Its whole economy had collapsed in just a few years. So you had these networks were all still active. And this is something that was spurning on a massive push to annex Canada into the United States. And this is like creating, you had Mexico too. You had a Republican Juarez, President Juarez in Mexico as well. You had this American system moving on into Russia, Germany. I mean, these are things that are pretty well, you know, pretty powerful. But then to see Canadians' participation in this as well as being... Well, and the fact that it was just written away. I mean, what are you going to fight for as a Canadian? What will your identity be as a Canadian if you think that we've just always been sort of pre-Confederate post, or like pre-1865 when we received our own little special constitution, or 1867 when we received our own special little constitution from the Queen, saying that, you know, it's our primary objective to serve the Queen, but, you know, we're basically free. I mean, what if you just have this dry dates and events conception, then you start seeing how this personality develops in a lot of the Canadians around Montreal and just around. What we have to cultivate is this sense of pride in where they came from, and where we all came from, to give us something to fight for. And that maybe human nature isn't bad too. That's a good start too. But this is what's been going on in the world there. Vive la Bruche movement. We've also got our website up and re-energized. It's been that way for about 2-3 weeks now, where we've maybe 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks,
a week,
really.
It's about 2 weeks.
I'm looking at it. Okay, I'm on it like three times a day, so it seems like it's been longer.
And you live there? Oh, maybe a week and a half. It was the last Tuesday that Lynn had a meeting with the...
Oh, really? That was it?
And then the Wednesday, they were starting, I think.
Yeah? Okay.
It's only been like a week and a
few days. Okay, there you go. Cool. Well, this thing is, I mean, what we've done is turn this website from a simply information-based site where that's updated maybe twice a week to something that's updated 3-4 times a day. And, I mean, every single breaking piece of information, like, half the stuff in this briefing was just like, holy shit.
Really?
Well, not half, but a significant portion, but just things that just arise as they occur.
Okay.
To really try and use that as a platform for shaping the... I mean, Lyndon LaRouche isn't running for presidency or anything, but what we have to do now is shape the landscape of the political scene as it's emerging now too, which was once again where not only this work is going to come in absolutely necessary in these updates, but working with congressional offices, working with ambassadors, working with delegates, and just working through Kepler even, because that's a huge part of our, like, the science based initiative is the huge element of our that differentiates this movement from anything else that's going on in the world. And working through, you know, this stuff with legislative aides is key if you're going to get people with any chance of thinking, or being responsible enough to guide a country. And, you know, working with people who are currently fighting this push for world government and this push for depopulation globally is really our only choice. So it comes down to a question of, you know, whether or not we've got, you know, if you want a future, the answer's pretty easy. It's just a matter of looking into this from a different axiomatic standpoint than what we're led to believe. And if you don't, well, we can just keep going with the flow. But it's like, it's pretty easy to answer a question for most people. Just like Pascal was demonstrating earlier on, sometimes you just got to ask the right question to put those pieces together, right? And just find the right words. That's largely the what we're doing. I mean, we were originally going to, before this nice global warming induced, I'm sure, snowstorm hit us, we were going to have a larger presentation between Jerry, Dave, and I. And I guess I don't know if we still want to do something of a similar nature, talking about maybe going into Al Gore a little bit. If you guys are curious. I don't really know what you've been digging up at all.
I haven't been so much digging.
No?
I didn't really take the time to go through the Gore files, but
okay.
I did manage to read them in favor a couple times.
Okay.
I like to bring up some of the relevant aspects of what you're discussing.
Sure. Oh, yeah, really, there's a lot that we sort of looked at there, but,
yeah, that's good.
I mean, regarding, y'all see the global warming swindle? Did you get a chance to look at that? The global, you saw that twice, yeah, you did.
Yeah.
You saw it?
Yeah, I saw it
like
three times.
Oh, nice, sure, cool.
Yeah, man. So is that on the site?
Yeah, it's on Google Video, we have a link to it on our Montreal site. There's a couple of cool classes that I think might be key to. I should turn that off.
So I just like to Google Swindle.